One of the things that I like about going to visit mum and dad is that they have this really long couch. And it's cool because I can in fact fit on the couch. I don't have to have my legs hanging over the side. And I have to confess that I've kind of coveted this couch for a while, just being able to, you know, just stretch out and relax and watch the Idiot Box. It's a great thing. And so this week I decided to succumb to these temptations, and I have purchased a couch long enough for me to lie down on. Now, I had a couple of friends over subsequently, and I had to show off the couch, and a couple of them were like challenging me and saying, "Oh, you know, you priests are living in this luxury and, you know, having these big couches that you can lie down on. This is, you know, a terrible thing." And it kind of struck me as I was pondering this later on about the relationship to the body and to pleasure and to life and the way that we kind of think that a Christian should be and a priest should be. You know, how should we be in the world? What should our attitude be? Of course, there are movements like the Puritans. We had this week the midterm elections in the US, and there was a huge influence of the Tea Party, and was part of the grand old party, the GOP. The Tea Party, of course, really represent the very right wing of American society and also of Christendom. You know, very evangelical, sometimes very fundamentalist, coming from that puritanical kind of mindset that says that, you know, bodily pleasure is always kind of suspect, if not bad. That the point of the Christian life is to be purified of all of these desires. And consequently, you know, I shouldn't have been getting a nice comfortable couch. I should have had a nice wooden bench to sit on, and I shouldn't have had the TV at all. But then you have, you know, a much more materialistic kind of attitude or vision of life that says, no, bodily pleasures is the whole of the thing. And I'm sure we all know people who are, you know, caught up in that kind of attitude or mindset. You know, this is the whole world that we'll ever experience, and so we should make the very most of it right here and right now, because there is nothing at the end. Which then leads to the question, well, what does indeed happen to us when we die? What is the end result? What happens? And again, if you take, you know, a straw poll of people, and, you know, it's a question that people continue to ask and continue to survey people on, what happens when we die? There's probably only, you know, a few kind of general opinions. You get the materialists who will then say, well, nothing happens when you die. Your body simply is burnt in the cremation, or it just simply rots away in the grave, and that's it. You have the grand old party. You have these Puritans who say, no, it's all about the spirit. And what happens when you die is that the soul that is within you escapes the body, and the soul then goes to heaven, and the body just rots away. But the body doesn't matter, because the point of our life is the salvation of our soul, and the body doesn't really matter. A lot of those kind of thoughts and questions and the whole attitude is really an extension of the teaching of Plato, back 400 years before Christ. Plato, of course, said that the soul is the most important thing in us, that the point of life is to educate and to entertain and to inform the soul so that it can escape from the prison of the body into the world of the forms. And that is the whole point of life. The forms are the main thing. And if we're to be honest, perhaps many of us are really quite informed by that. You know, that puritanical teaching is quite strong. Maybe we have that sense of this very strong dualism of the body and the spirit. And the spirit is a thing that's good, and anything that we derive pleasure in is consequently quite bad. But, my friends, that is not Catholic teaching. Catholic teaching forms this middle path that says the body is good, material pleasure is good, but of course the spirit is also good. But we bring them both together into this quite wonderful unity. So I think Catholic teaching does say that you can indeed have a nice, comfortable couch, because it is part of a much bigger whole. Okay, I'm justifying myself here, but anyway. I say all this because of our readings tonight. In the Old Testament, you see lots of different kind of ideas and thoughts about what happens when you die. In some of the Psalms, for example, in Psalm 88 and Psalm 115, you see this very materialistic sense. It says things like, well, the dead cannot praise you. Those who go down into the dead can no longer see your face. This sense that once there is death, that's it. Nothing more happens. In other places, you get this teaching about a place called Sheol, a place where very little happens, a place where it's just people kind of biding their time, a place of darkness, a place of kind of dreariness. But by the time we get to the book of 2 Maccabees, which is our first reading, we see a quite remarkable new teaching that begins to emerge. Scholars are a bit perplexed about this second book of Maccabees. They can date the first book a little bit more clearly. The second book is probably written about 100 years before Christ. It talks about events around the period about 180 BC to 160 BC, the time of the Seleucid Empire, the Greek Empire that had conquered that southern part of Israel and down in through Egypt. The Seleucids were quite vicious, and they were very wanton to destroy all that lay in their path. And so the Maccabees were this group who then said, no, we need to stand opposed to this. And they organized a rebellion against the Seleucid Empire. That's around 167 BC, BCE. And so all of the events that come around this speak of this new understanding. And you see in these seven brothers who are here portraying their sense of martyrdom, the Seleucids are saying, you must conform to all of our religion. You must conform to all of our practices. And part of that is, you must eat this pork. And the brothers are saying, no, it's against the law of Moses. We will not do that. We will not pollute our lives and consequently go against the will of God. And so they'd rather suffer martyrdom than go against that sense of the will of God for them. And so you have, you know, this quite interesting and tantalizing account of their martyrdom. If you read the whole of 2 Maccabees 7, you get the very gory kind of details about what happened. And because this is a G-rated program, I won't go into it now, but you can read that later on. They have this strong sense that the reason that they're able to do this is because they know that God is the creator and God is good. And so God created them in the first place. God gave them their hands and their feet. God gave them their tongues that are about to be cut off by their torturers. And they said, look, we trust in God. We will willingly give these things to you, knowing that God will raise us again in the future. He will restore our bodies. It's not just of the soul escaping the body. It's this very integrated sense of the wholeness. It's not our soul that matters. It's me, it's my unity, it's the whole thing, the whole aspect of who I am. That is what matters. And this is the teaching that then informs Jesus' teaching. Jesus clearly has been influenced by this same school of thought, and he's teaching exactly the same thing. But the Sadducees, that sect within Judaism that are caught up in the temple worship, they're very wealthy generally, they're supporters of the Roman Empire, and they say, no, it's only the first five books, or the Pentateuch. They're the only books in the Old Testament that have authority. And in the first five books, there is no mention of the resurrection, or no direct mention. And so they're able to say, look, all that we have, all that we see, is just what happens to us. And when we die, we simply rot in the grave. That's it. No, end of story. And so the teaching of Jesus is challenging them. Remember, this gospel takes place in the final week, in Holy Week. And so all of the tension that's beginning to arise that will ultimately lead to the betrayal of Jesus and his death on Good Friday. And so all of this tension is beginning to arise as the different factions and groups are beginning to come around Jesus and to question him. And so in the midst of this, Jesus then makes this most wonderful declaration. As he says, you know, as they offer this rather absurd story of these seven brothers. Because they know the book of Deuteronomy 25, where it says in there that if a man dies without his wife having conceived a child, if he has a brother, then the brother's responsibility and duty is to marry that woman and provide a continuance of her name and of that family line. Now they take that law to the ad absurdum of saying, you know, the example of seven brothers. It's an absurd example, but it's one that they seem to think proves that there can be no resurrection. How could this be the case? And Jesus answers, of course, first by saying, you don't understand what is happening. But then he gives us that rather intriguing line, that in the world to come, there will be no marrying. Again, this has challenged many people. I remember talking to Mum and Dad about it, and you know, they were worried about it. You know, they're so in love. We've celebrated their golden wedding anniversary. But the sense of it is that there won't necessarily be marriage, because what's the point of marriage? It is that propagation of life and love. It's to continue the life in the next generation. That has passed. When we get to the resurrection of the dead, there is no need for that. We all live forever. So there's no need for that propagation. Yet, there will be that sense that husbands and wives will know and love and recognize and share that special intimacy. An intimacy that will be heightened and elevated. An intimacy that will be shared in an even deeper and more wonderful way. Something that I'm sure for those of you who perhaps have lost your spouse, something to look forward to in the world to come, that incredible gift and joy of being able to continue more deeply in love than you ever experienced in the present age. Then Jesus gives the example of at the time of Moses when he had the burning bush in Exodus 5, when he had that incredible experience of the bush burning and not being consumed. And the Lord revealed himself to Moses as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. People who were dead for 400 or more years, and yet the God of the living. Jesus is reminding us that the way we worship is of a God who created us whole, a God who loved us into being physically and spiritually in this most amazing and wonderful unity, a unity that will not be destroyed by death, a unity that can never be destroyed because of the love that God has for us. As we move into this final phase in our liturgical year, there is this profound sense of the wonder of what God has done, this true sense of the God who continues to create and pour life upon us. Let us rejoice indeed in the God who gives us life, who wants us to enjoy life now, but to enjoy and to worship him forever in that incredible gift of heaven, and particularly in the new creation when heaven and earth are united and we once again have our bodies restored in all of their wonder and all of their glory to worship him and to love one another forever.